Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Nafisa Thompson-Spires has a new collection of short stories called Heads of the Colored People. Each of her stories takes us deep into the minds of very original characters, like a funeral singer who grieves for the young black boys who were victims of gun violence. The title of her collection comes from a long-running series of literary sketches that were written in the 19th century by James McCune Smith.
McCune Smith was an abolitionist and a doctor who was publishing these sketches individually in Frederick Douglass's newspapers and trying to think through black citizenship at the time. So he's representing a lot of working class and middle class black people from sketches that range kind of from the macabre to really realistic. But he's really thinking about overall what it would look like for black people to have the full rights of citizenship during that period.
McCune Smith was the first African American to hold a medical degree and the first one to run a pharmacy in the United States. Is that correct?
Right.
So how would you say that your short stories differ from McCune Smith's literary sketches?
Well, the time period is a significant difference, though it's also in some ways not one. When I initially started writing, I thought I would sort of update each of McCune Smith's sketches individually, but that became really restrictive. And what I found was that some things have changed. I mean, black people do have rights on paper, but a lot of the conversations that we're having about voter suppression and whether Black Lives Matter, state-sanctioned violence, all of those things are things that McCune Smith was very much concerned with in his day and that we're still concerned with today.
And also something like police brutality?
Exactly.
What kinds of characters did you want to write about in the 12 stories that make up this collection?
I wanted to write about black characters that I felt I hadn't seen as much. That's not to say no one's ever written about black nerds. I wanted to see the kinds of black characters I felt like I was as a kid in particular. So black people who were one of the only black people in a particular space, like a private school, black kids who weren't considered black enough, or black adults who are struggling through white academia. So those were the characters, people who are often read as exceptional in some way or another, whether they are or aren't.
Mm. And the opening story in your collection is the title story, the full title of which is Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology. Can you tell me a bit about this story?
Yeah. The story came in part from the James McCune Smith sketches, but also some of his contemporaneous writers like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and William Wilson, and they were all writing these literary sketches at the time for similar reasons. But I wanted to think about this character who came to my head. I just had this idea of Riley wore blue contacts and bleached his hair blonde. That line wouldn't leave me alone for a few days. And I started trying to figure out who this Riley character was. And it seemed like an easy way to explore him was through cosplay culture and people who are very much into comic books and these conventions and who dress up against racial type, so who are trying to do cross-racial or trans-racial cosplay. And I'd read articles about black people getting backlash for doing that. You know, cosplay purists don't want you to dress as an Asian character if you aren't Asian, or if you aren't white, to dress as a white character. And what would it mean to try to operate in those spaces in spite of that tension?
Now would be the perfect time to have you read the opening paragraphs from this story.
Sure. So this is Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology. Riley wore blue contact lenses and bleached his hair, which he worked with gel and a blow dryer and a flat iron some mornings into Sonic the Hedgehog spikes so stiff you could prick your finger on them, and sometimes into a wispy side-swooped bob with long bangs. And he was black. But this wasn't any kind of self-hatred thing. He'd read The Bluest Eye and Invisible Man in school, and even picked up Disgruntled at a book fair. And yes, they were good, and there was some resonance in those books for him. But this story isn't about race or the shame of being alive or any of those things. He was not self-hating. He was even listening to Drake, though you could make it Fetty Wap if his appreciation for trap music changes something for you, because all that's relevant here is that he wasn't against the music of his people or anything like that as he walked down Figueroa with his earbuds pushed in just far enough so as not to feel itchy. Riley was wearing the wispy swooped version of his bangs and listening to Drake or Fetty, and he was black with blue contacts and bleached blonde hair, and yes, there are black people who have both of those things naturally, without the use of artificial accoutrement, so we can move past the whole phenotypically this or biologically that discussion to the meat of things. And if there's something meta in this narrator's consciousness and self-consciousness, or this overindulgent aside, it isn't meta for the sake of being meta. This narrator's consciousness is just letting you know about said consciousness up front, like a raised black fist, to get the close reading out of the way and make space for Riley, who was the kind of black man for whom blue eyes and blonde hair were not natural. He was the kind of black that warranted, or invited without solicitation, comparisons to drinks from Starbucks, or lyrics from Lady Marmalade, or chocolate bars with nuts. You would think with his blue contacts and unnaturally blonde hair set against dark chocolate mocha chocolata ya-ya skin, and yes, there is some judgment in the use of you, that Riley would date white or Asian women exclusively, or perhaps that he liked men. But you'd be wrong on both counts, as Riley was straight and he dated widely among black women, and he was neither in denial, nor on the down low, nor like John Mayer, equal opportunity in United Colors of Benetton in life, but as separate as the fingers of the hand in sex, nor like Frederick Douglass or many others working on black rights in public and going home to a white wife. And there's no judgment against Douglass here, just facts for the sake of descriptive clarity. Riley liked black women, both their blackness and womanness, and the overlap between those constructs. Nor was Riley queerphobic or the type of man to utter no homo in uncomfortable situations, because Riley was comfortable enough, if enough, expresses a sort of educated awareness. There's so much awareness in these two paragraphs that I've hardly made space for Riley, who in addition to black women liked cosplay, dressing up as characters from his favorite books and movies, Doctor Who and Rurouni Kenshin, and the Comic Love Convention, and especially Death Note, his favorite manga and anime series. And though that day he was dressed as Tamaki Suo per his girlfriend's request, in a skinny periwinkle suit with a skinny black tie, his appearance gave him the flexibility to on other occasions dress as Kisei Ryoto or Naruto, or if he were feeling especially bold, Super Saiyan.
Thank you. That was great. I love your use of meta commentary in this story. You even take it to another level when you write that. It isn't meta for the sake of being meta. It's very funny. Why did you want to add this level of meta commentary to the title story?
It's funny. I think meta gets a bad rap among certain kinds of MFA types. In one way, it was just a dig at those types.
Yeah.
But in another way, I think it's a signal that the whole collection itself is doing this other kind of work. So, yes, these are stories, and at their very baseline, they're supposed to be read for entertainment and for pleasure, but they're also art, and they're also social commentary. And I wanted all of those three things to be going on at once and to gesture towards the fact that, you know, every story in here is meta, whether it seems meta or not.
Yeah. I've read that your characters are based on observations of real people and you use methods that you learned from Louise Fitzhugh's classic kids lit character, Harriet the Spy. Is that true?
That is also very true. I'm a big fan of spy notes and I kind of took the wrong lesson away from Harriet the Spy. I think spy notes can help you do a lot of things as long as you're discreet.
And you still do that. You actually have like a spy notebook like she did and you observe people and take notes of things they say.
I have many spy notebooks, yes.
That's great. Yeah, well, that's paying off, isn't it? One of your characters, Fatima, appears in three of the stories. Can you tell me a bit about Fatima and why you wanted to write about her character three times over the course of the book?
It's funny. I had a hard time shaking Fatima, and I'm still writing about her, so my novel in progress is also about her. But I felt that I hadn't finished telling about her by the end of the first story. I initially was trying to write a novel about this character, and I found that it was easier to kind of get at some of her concerns in shorter vignettes, and then eventually those vignettes became a couple of short stories. But I also wanted us to see multiple angles. So in Belle Lettre, for example, we don't really see Fatima. We see her mother talking about her. And then in Fatima the Biloquist, it's the first time that we get kind of a close lens on her, but we have a third-person kind of snarky narrator. And Fatima never got her own voice in either of those stories. So in The Body's Defenses Against Itself, we actually get a first-person account from her about her life. And so I liked that idea of exploring her from these three different points of view, three different angles. And again, I still don't feel like I'm finished thinking through the complications of her life.
One reviewer, David Canfield, says that Fatima's coming of age as a black woman is key to your book. And he wrote that it's, quote, a meditation on the nuances of identity formation and how it's complicated by identity markers, black, affluent, that defy entrenched social structures, end quote. What do you think of that description?
I think it's a strong description. I would add that it's not just the identity markers of class and blackness, but also femaleness. Fatima's struggling a lot with her body in those stories, especially in The Body's Defenses and Fatima the Biloquist. She's living with an undiagnosed illness that really makes her worried about how womanly she is. And that's something that comes up in the novel that I'm working on now even more.
Do you see a lot of yourself in Fatima?
In some ways, yes. We have somewhat parallel upbringings, and we both have endometriosis, which is the diagnosis she eventually gets in that story. So, yeah, there's definitely a part of me in Fatima, more than probably any of the other characters in the collection.
Mm. You've said that you hope your stories will help readers, quote, rethink what's allowed as authentically Black and what isn't, end quote. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think we're getting better all the time in that way because there are so many smart young people who refuse that kind of easy categorization. But I felt for a long time that there's been a very limited sense of what counts as authentically Black. That, you know, there's people like to use the phrase the Black community or the Black experience as though there's this monolithic linear experience that everyone has. And it's just not true. I grew up upper middle class in a really diverse neighborhood and in a really white school and had a hard time moving back and forth between the settings of my neighborhood and my school or my church, which was Black. And being told that I wasn't Black enough because of the way I spoke or because of the shoes I was wearing or the music I listened to. And that's a lot of people's experience, that particular tastes make them seem less part of that singular Black experience. And I want to say the Black experience is plural. There are many Black experiences and that there are lots of ways that one might experience it. But when it comes down to it, class, position, privileges don't sort of accept someone from still encountering violence as a Black person. My education, whatever money I had, none of those things kept me from being Black, authentically Black in a store when a white woman followed me around or any of that. So we're all living the same sorts of oppression, whether we have privilege or not. And the Blackness is sort of the common denominator of that, but there are many ways to live that Blackness out.
Nafisa Thompson Spires is the author of the short story collection, Heads of the Colored People.